IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 43 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl, and I'm joined by Ryan and Dave, and at least two of the three of us have had an interesting week. How about you, Ryan?
A very productive week. I am in the office and cranking stuff out. No airplane rides this week.
I've been at home too. It's been, Carl, you're the only one on planes, but yes, I've had one of those multiple podcasts plus webinars days.
Right. I'd say we've been playing on the internet, just even if you're not leaving the house.
Well, that's true. And you did a webinar from a show, and then I did a live stream commenting on it. We've been so meta. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I went to a show. I taught a class one day online, and then the next day I did my State of the Nation address, and then Dave streamed a commentary on my State of the Nation address. So.
I have to laugh and go, if anybody wants to follow me on YouTube, Twitch, or Facebook, I am having lots of fun with live streaming. If you like additional comment that's a lot looser, that is distinctly the format of choice for me right now.
Nice. So did you get a good turnout on the live stream?
You know, they build over time. Because I haven't been scheduling them and announcing them, it's just sort of people who casually walk by. Yeah. But the videos get good views ongoing. I do anticipate scheduling them more ongoing so people can follow me in all the various places and find it on schedules. But as events come up, there will be more scheduled live streams.
Right. Cool. And do they, like, in your opinion, does it count as a video? Like, I know if you do something on YouTube, it's a video, but if you just like are like magically appearing on Facebook, do you consider that a video?
I don't know. Like, yeah, it's sort of laughing. I don't know. It's the on YouTube they show up as videos. They get classified differently. On Facebook they show up as a video in my feed, but they get announced differently. You know, it's one of those. If I want to count it from a production perspective, sure. Those that are interested in the way that I think about it, I actually sort of am more interested in weekly viewership and listenership is the way that I'm right. Kind of judging my own success.
Cool. All right. So, I guess we're all going to be just like hanging out for at least a week, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So
January tends to be slower for travel. This is at least from my perspective. I'm not scheduled to go anywhere until February. So it's nice.
Next week I'm headed to Boston and to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And then the week after that, I'm actually headed to Riga, Latvia, because Latvia is exactly the place you would plan a trip at the end of January.
Because it's practically tropical.
it's on the very same latitude, apparently, as Stockholm, Sweden. It's north of Poland and within shouting distance of 24 hours of darkness in January.
So this should be a very good drinking trip because there's nothing else to do.
And you know this conference, they got a really good deal on the hotel rooms.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
It's right up there with CompTIA in Miami in August.
Exactly.
This is the winter equivalent of that.
Exactly. So, see, last week I was in Shanghai, China, and the weather there was actually quite nice. It was like 74 degrees and everything was great. And I thought, you know, there is a happy medium. We should all try a little bit harder to plan our conferences in the happy medium.
Yes.
So
yes.
True.
All right. Last comment and then we'll do a podcast. So Richard and Claire came from the UK, so they're from Newcastle upon Tyne, which is way up by Scotland, and it's on the North Sea. And so we're at this get together, outdoor party at night. It was 34 degrees. Claire's there with short sleeves and no jacket. She's like, "What's wrong with you people? It's not that cold."
It's all perspective.
So anyway, all right. So topic one today. I guess I want to talk about the 2020. Question and revisit a topic that we introduced a little bit of from a slightly different perspective. So the topic that we introduced earlier was about the splinter net, this whole concept of, you know, Russia creating or China creating their own internet. But now as it evolves, it looks like India can have some skirmishes in Kashmir and just shut down everything they disagree with on the internet. And like, that's part of their policy now. China and Russia developing an alternate internet. We seem to have this emergence of one group where the government uses the internet for their own purposes. And then we have another where it's mostly, I'd say 90% curated, not by a government, but by American companies. So you have kind of like Chinese government versus American companies sort of managing the two alternative internets. What does that do for us as a, not just in our industry, but, you know, as business people and people of the world?
Well, I gotta, from my perspective, I like to clarify this because there are two categories of internets and then subdivisions. On one side, you have authoritarian government run internets. The Chinese internet is different from the Russian one. Iran has had a number of government shutdowns. India has a number of government shutdowns. In fact, I've been tracking those out on the Business of Tech to talk about all those different ones. There are now websites that track that. On the democratic free, quote unquote, free speech internet, I actually do think that is subdividing very much into the American version and the European version because they are regulated differently.
Right.
Although the American version may come back into alignment with some of the new California laws.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think I might poke a little bit too at your statement of 90% by American companies. I'm not so sure anymore, particularly with the Europeans reasserting their right. Now, you ask the great question though, what does this mean? I think people, particularly, let's assume for a moment you're focused on the democratic side of things, because I think as a general rule, most of the people that we're talking about from a technology services perspective are going to be looking at this on the democratic side. I think you do need to understand, A, where your customers are a lot more than you did before, and who their customers are, because you're going to have to think about where the data is going at least two levels down to think about that. And I think that's right. My number one takeaway.
Well, and so Ryan, I'm hoping I'm going to spend a little more time in at least Southeast Asia, if not the rest of Asia, but you go there more than the two of us put together. So what's your perspective?
See, so this, I actually had this conversation with Chinese business professionals in China last week. We were having this conversation because, you know, Dave has mentioned this and we've discussed it in a previous podcast on the opportunity to understand where we think the splinter net is going. My observation was, I don't think it's going to be reasonable or technologically allowed for there to be one single platform on which everybody can transact and do business. So I'll take it like an extra division of internet resources. In other words, there will be not just authoritarian and commercial or democratic, but I think there will be a split between what is informational and what is transactional. And I think that that will make a very awkward and yet interesting place for us to do business again, right? It's like in the old days, you got on an airplane, you went to China, you had to do business the way they did business in order to transact with those kinds of opportunities. Today, I do an awful lot of business and communication, education, you can name it, with people who are based in all of those authoritarian countries. And I do it from sitting right here in my office in little old Gig Harbor, Washington, right? Today it is transparent. And when I travel over there, they know who I am and they understand how to interact with me in other ways. I think that's a temporary solution. And there's going to be a place where I will have to say, well, I can read the news, I can interact with my friends, I can do whatever social media that I want to do within the sphere of my internet, right? My, in this case, in terms of my democratic internet. But if I wish to do business, I will have to go to the transactional internet, and then that will be subdivided or watered down in order for us to trade across.
Let me, I want to offer a third perspective. I want to offer, because you said informational and transactional, and I'm nodding, going, okay. I want to add propagandist, and I actually want to, and I want to add it for both types, both democratic and authoritarian, because you find there is a ton more propaganda. And I can use that both in kind of a positive spin to go marketing stuff, or I can go negative, where if you put the proper use of the words fake news or misinformation. I laugh because there was a site I was playing with this morning, literally like Mute VC, which is a way of muting venture capitalists in your Twitter feed.
Right.
and, but it's so, the,
that's what I was just, in response to Ryan, I was just going to say, there's a couple things, and one of them is, it isn't so much authoritarian to me as government curated versus whatever, capitalist or company curated. And, you know, our internet started as completely government curated, right? It was universities and military and education, right? It was late in the game, businesses were allowed to get into it, and they had to justify why they get access to this government curated system. And maybe it is, the other thing I would say is, maybe it is the case that you're at the personal level, and when you move into the commercial level or into the political realm, you basically agree to their terms of service. And so you say, you know what, if I'm going to be on the Chinese internet at this level, I agree not to talk about this and not to bring up these things. And, you know, in some sense, you give up, right? We've been giving up our privacy in exchange for access. Now we're going to give up a little free speech in exchange for access.
Well, we've given up our privacy in exchange for free stuff here in the too. So, I mean, it's all relative. I think what the unfortunate piece is that the responsibility right now does fall on the user, the end user, to understand this stuff. If you're in technology services, you've got to think about this for your customer and your customer's customer, and really start processing that out. It may be super simple, right? You may go, look, I'm in a particular section of Europe or a particular section of the US, and I know all of my customers are local. But I would poke that, because most businesses have some level beyond what you can see in terms of their engagement. Right. They have vendors
Is there a B2B internet and a B2C internet?
Maybe. I think we just need, there is, at some point we're going to have to be tackling this. I mean, maybe what we're talking about here is maybe somebody has to start building the tracking tools and the information to give you insight into that.
Yeah,
maybe that's an opportunity.
A navigation map that says what is authorized or allowed within any of the neighborhoods, right? Basically like a language and customs map for the new SplinterNet. The one thing that I can say for sure, I posed the question in a room full of Chinese business professionals, and I said, do you believe that it is possible to reconcile these two different ideas about information dissemination, freedom of speech, the access to unlimited resources and commercial opportunities? Do you think it's possible? And it was absolutely universal. No. There is no way that you will convince that government or others like it that they need to surrender control in order to facilitate commerce. They are of a mind that at this point in time, barring some sort of significant change in leadership, there's absolutely no chance that that's going to be surrendered for the sake of commercial growth. So it's not like this is a theoretical conversation. This is absolutely tactical.
Right. It's odd, though. We're free because we give Google the right to take all of our information and track every single thing we do. They're not free because they, you know, their government does exactly the same thing. So,
yeah.
All right. Any final words before we move on?
We're not solving that one today.
Well, you know, I my whole approach to anything remotely political is, the world is a very complicated place. And so, you know, it's not like you get to solve these problems. Topic number two, is the MSP market saturated And what does that actually mean? And is it actually possible?
No, topic solved.
So I'll give a little context on this because, you know, I'm constantly tracking market statistics around all the business models and opportunities in the IT channel. You know, whether you are a product reseller or a managed service provider, whether you are professional services, et cetera, right? And I think it's incumbent on us in the business to understand what's happening around us. And I came across this article that was talking about the impact of economic growth on the opportunity for managed service providers. In other words, the article's theory was, well, the economy's been exploding. There are lots of companies coming in. Therefore, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for a managed service provider who can solve complex technology problems. However, semicolon, in their thesis, there was a fundamental presumption that said, yeah, and by the way, the market for managed services in this economy in the article, as well as generally speaking, is saturated, as we all know, and the saturation of the marketplace has a cascade of economic effects. And I was absolutely stopped cold, and I was like, wait a second. I'm going to have to go down this rabbit hole and find if, is there any other source of statistic that would corroborate that managed services in North America has achieved any level of market saturation. And I came across a bunch of numbers. And as an amateur economist, I will say there wasn't one of them that could have been interpreted as anything remotely close to saturation.
Yeah, I think, didn't Jay say it's something like 70% of companies have never had any kind of IT services? I was like, that's not saturation.
Right.
See, that was one of the statistics that I came across. Another that basically said, if you take this from the ground up and you say the number of companies that have even one, if not wholesale outsourcing of IT systems management in a comprehensive managed services way, but even one, like you manage my backup or you manage my whatever service as a discrete offering, the percentage of end user organizations that have some form of a current or existing managed services contract, fewer than one in five. It was like 18% today. And I get that those numbers are radically skewed by the very small business calculation, right? If you go to the Small Business Administration and you say there's 20 odd million companies, of which something like 90% of them are under $500,000 in annual revenue. I understand that. But even if you just go to going concerns over $1 million in revenue, the best I can calculate is that we're somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 penetration. I found that to be radically inaccurate.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can poke at the people should read this article and then go, not true. I look at this and I'm going to say a couple of things. So first off, if we go to some of the people that are generating lists, obviously I spent a good portion of my life as a vendor. They'll quote all the time that there is 10% new businesses, 10% entering, 10% leaving the space of technology delivery every single year. So I go, okay, well, if there's 10%, then we're not saturated because people are creating new businesses there.
Right.
There's definitely that. There's definitely, when we look at, if you look at, think of it, a long tail of business, right? I'm pretty confident the Fortune 500 all have somebody they're working with, right, from a technology services perspective. So if you want to go like, are they saturated? Yeah, sure. But if I go to the long tail, mid-market, out to small business, I think Ryan's numbers are totally viable. And I see this in both numerically, and then I see it anecdotally. The number of times I can talk to a small business person and they're like, oh, I don't work with anybody from my IT.
Right.
Like, it just happens all the time. And then the other piece, and I've been struggling with this all the time recently, and I was quite pessimistic about it this week as well, is the, look, if everybody had an IT provider and stuff, and it was going well, I don't think ransomware would be a thing. Yes. So like, you know, and so, I mean, they're being, even companies that have them are being ravaged, much less the massive number of companies that are being under attack by this. And by the way, these are all problems that are technically solvable. Like, not these ransomware stuff is solvable from a patching security layer. Like, you can solve this stuff.
Well, from our perspective, being in this particular industry, when I think about starting a company, one of the things I think of is somebody has to take care of the computers. But you don't think like that if you're going into legal, medical, right, bookkeeping, manufacturing, right? Whatever other industry you go into, computers are just an expense. And maintenance and management is not something you would naturally think of. Well, so it isn't clear to most people starting a business that they need to do anything about the computer.
It depends, because if your perspective on technology is that this is going to enable the entire business, then you are distinctly willing to spend money on that. But a lot of newer businesses are.
But those are technology businesses, right? And, you know, the other perspective is all businesses are technology businesses. So if that's the case, those who don't define themselves as technology businesses are the ones who probably don't have.
Well, see, and I will go from a consumer behavior point of view, right? We're all familiar with the idea of the bell curve of market adoption, from innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, et cetera, right? What I have often advocated is that it's not a question of whether or not one of those where you fit on that bell curve of adoption relative to a particular offering, right? It's not like one of those categories will or will not adopt a particular service offering. It's that they will adopt it for a specific reason, right? An innovator will adopt a new service offering because it creates competitive differentiation in the marketplace, whereas a laggard adopter will adopt a new service because it helps them to reduce their cost of operation, right? I looked at it and said, if you just do fundamental math, right? And we do a lot of sales management coaching and consulting in our business. And we also spend a lot of time with individual salespeople. The implications that this article said, because it's saturated, therefore there are two real problems. Number one is that there's downward price pressure on the marketplace and it's hard to hold your value-based pricing. And number two, it's really difficult to find and recruit talent, both technical and sales-wise. And I will say absolutely positively true on both of those challenges. Recruiting is hard and pricing is going down. And I will disagree fundamentally on the cost. It's not because of saturation, it's because of a lack of effectiveness in the way that we go to market and the way that we position and promote ourselves, because I cannot tell you how many times, to Dave's point anecdotally, do they want to hire us as their managed service provider? They don't know what a managed service provider is, right? They've never even heard of it. And I can't fathom that equals saturation. Although, and it's not new, right? I remember going on roadshow events 12, 13 years ago, talking about how any price pressure in the managed services marketplace was voluntary and artificial, not based on saturation, but based on a lack of sales effectiveness.
All right. So
I'd argue that's where we still are.
I agree with you 100% on staffing, and I know that that's a big issue. I totally disagree on price pressure. Dipple's been saying for ages, and he's got real data on this, that says there isn't price pressure on these markets, that people are doing it, and I do think it's artificial. And particularly considering the massive fines, the massive ransom people are having to pay on this, they're going to pay it one way or the other. You know, I mean, a Texas school system was swindled out of $2.3 million last month. I believe their IT budget's going up.
$2.1 million budget would have saved them a lot of money.
Would save them a lot of money. I don't buy it on this whole price pressure thing. I think that just comes from the fact that that people aren't confident enough in their services and they don't deliver it.
No, so you're going exactly where I'm going, right? I believe that everybody says there is price pressure, and I believe that in every one of those marketplaces, there is still a spot where a value-based sales organization Richard could come in and win that very same business at a premium price point. There is absolutely no rule that says you must sell on discount. It's just a habit that that's the way we do sell.
Well, and technology. One of the things that I mentioned the other day in my presentation is, you know, the larger you get, the more likely it is that the sales department is going to say, hey, if you need to cut the price in order to make a sale, do so. And that is 100% artificial downward pressure brought on by their internal processes and the fact that they have a large sales force.
Yeah. See, the problem is not that you cannot charge a premium price for these services. The problem might be that you cannot charge a premium price for these services.
It's not that one cannot, it's that you can. So I guess my last thought on this is that, you know, with the whole concept of saturation, I have anecdotally talked to many, many people who say every person that we talk to already has an IT shop. And all I can think of is go talk to a different group of people, right? You know, like subscribe to the list of every new business that registered for a business license in your city. Those are for sale every day of the week. You know, if you go sign up for business license or you do a DBA, you're going to be inundated with offers from everything you can possibly imagine. You know, maybe that's the people you should be talking to because not one of them has hired an MSP.
Yeah, not yet. Not if they register.
Not on the day they file. So, all right. Are we, are we done?
We sufficiently beat
stuff away on discount.
We'll be back. We'll discuss this again. All righty. Number three. Was this yours, Dave?
This business? Is my. So, well, because this is where everybody gets the insight into the warm-up, because we started talking about this and we said, wait a second, this is a good topic.
Yeah,
we should talk about this. So on Monday, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella was quoted on a number of things at an event. And the one that caught my eye most, and I talked about it on the Business Tech, but I think it's worth us all expanding on it, was that he's been quoting an economic expert from Northwestern University, Robert Gordon. And he's done this before, but he came out again saying that he was talking about how technological progress hasn't led to broad economic growth the way experts thought. And his quote is, quite frankly, I'm worried. Carl, you had your State of the SMB webinar this week, and you talked about the fact that, you know, the markets have been going up and you are anticipating something coming, but you didn't know what it was. And I'm more pessimistic because I did a post show and and I come in and said, I think it's 2020. I think this is the year something is coming. But I am also concerned about some of these larger trends that are around, you know, that we're not seeing technology really driving the broad economy the way I think we all hoped. I'm starting to feel that way. And I'm seeing some negative economic trends in a larger sense. Wealth inequality is a problem. We've got a very much an aging population. And for the first few time in really in our history, we have life expectancy starting to go down on people. So I am a little bit more pessimistic on the economy, and it appears so is Nadella. And I thought it out for good to throw this one out for chat.
Well, and I'm reminded of, it's been now almost exactly a year since I heard about Hans Rosling's book called Factfulness, about, you know, why things are much better than you think they are in terms of world population, how wealthy people are worldwide, not just in the U.S. or Europe, you know, number of people who are vaccinated, number of girls who are educated, on and on and on. Many, many things are heading in the right direction. And I wonder if, you know, Gordon being an economist, this is one of those eras where economists have to push the reset button and realize there might be different measures than there used to be about how we should measure whether or not this economy is, you know, moving in the right direction, or, you know, are the measurements of growth the same as they were 20, 30 years ago?
Well, by the way, they can both be true at the same time.
Sure.
I mean, I think that's the other thing that's important to know is because I said it before, I'll say it again for those that weren't on the pre-show, is the this is the best time to be alive as a human being in all of history, right? You have access to the best resources, things like best medicine, but that doesn't mean that, you know, problems like life expectancy going down is also not true.
Right. Well, or it doesn't mean that we're done. Just because you say, look, things are things are better than you might believe doesn't mean that, like, okay, so let's just relax and not do anything about it.
Well, right. See, and again, I think if you take this back to the thesis of what Nadella's comments were about, right? Is there innovation? Yes, there's brilliant new technologies. I am famous for saying, I think there's more cool stuff out there in technology today than there has ever been. More new capability, advanced functionality, more disruptive opportunities today than we have ever seen before. I think we are innovating at a radically accelerated pace. But does that translate into quote unquote economic benefits? Well, it depends on how you're measuring those things. If you're measuring it in the terms, some macro sense of like uber macro of GDP, does our economy get larger? Yes, it does. And it has, other than recessionary periods, right? It has continued to do so over the decades. But if you measure it in the individual sense, which is much more closely tied to the idea of employment or job opportunities, does innovation create more jobs? That is a question that, where the answer so far today is absolutely no, because we are producing more and creating more economic value, dollars and cents in revenue, but we're doing it with fewer and fewer humans through automation and technology.
Except the employment rate. The unemployment rate is the lowest it's ever been, right?
Yeah, so, but that's a question.
You know, there are being jobs created. The other thing is that we sort of started this discussion with that some rough measure of this growth is are companies being created. And that's why I say maybe that's not the measure anymore, right? We should start an Amazon Prime Delivery Index and just count how many trucks the three of us see go by during one of these recordings, right? It could be that you don't need to start a company if you can use Amazon as your economy. I'm just going to get into the Amazon system, sell my stuff there, right? That will be, I don't care about the rest of the economy.
But is that good for you? You, by your own admission, have said that they're an awful partner.
I'm not saying I'm smart. I'm just saying
right.
It's so, an option.
See, now I will go back to, this has been a conversation that I've been having with people from a technology industry point of view for a number of years. There was an article published in Inc. magazine way back in the golden oldie days of 2013. It was based on an interview and an article that was published by Clay Christensen, and you guys might know him from the book, The Innovator's Solution, The Innovator's Dilemma, right? He's written a number of other things. In the article, and I've included this in the show notes, it's talking about the fact that there are three different kinds of innovation. There are empowering innovations, there are sustaining innovations, there are efficiency innovations. In other words, an empowering innovation, based on this new capability, we can do stuff we have never been able to do before. Creates new opportunity, businesses, and jobs. A sustaining innovation says, I can do what I've always done, but I can do it so much better than I've ever done it before that I can make more money without actually consuming or providing any additional resources. The third type, efficiency innovations, I can do what I always do less expensively, right? If you look at the impact on jobs, an efficiency innovation actually reduces the number of jobs. And the fundamental point that Clay's making in the article is that the stock market and short-termism and the way that venture capital is measured, the way that our economic system is designed to reward people right now, all of the reward is focused on efficiency innovations, not on empowering innovations. We are here as an industry, as an economy, to help people do what they already do, but do it cheaper so that you can drive down your expenses, up your profits, up your stock market price, and that's the only thing anybody cares about.
Well, let me tie this with the last topic. I gotta say, in our industry, what's happening is that we are actually creating tremendous empowerment. And people are maintaining their prices. I have talked to three people in the last 2 days who have two-person shops with $500,000 in recurring revenue annually, and several people who are one-person shops doing $300,000 top-line revenue. That was literally not possible 15 years ago. We have such great tools. We have, you know, we're relying on the cloud instead of on servers. And so we have tremendous efficiencies. Now, that doesn't mean there's necessarily more jobs to be had, but we've all sort of casually agreed it's a tough market to hire any technicians these days, which means they're off doing something.
Well, and by the way, we are quickly sliding between micro and macro trends. So for, you know, I think we have to be self-critical here. Yeah. I mean, we've go from a large trend about the availability of workforce all the way down to individual successes. And I think the point of this conversation is that I, from my vantage point, we, the technology services delivery people, need to be having smarter conversations about this amongst ourselves, about what we want to measure this in, what we want to do with it. And I think that we need to be part of the larger societal conversation about what the expectations are. I say that because this is going to be the year of new regulation. And if we're not involved in the conversation, it will be decided for us.
I agree. I would just say one thing, one of my favorite themes of life is that you are an economy of one. So while we should look at all those trends, any specific person listening to this should understand you do not have to be dominated by what the economy is doing, what Amazon is doing, what Satya Nadella thinks. or anything we say on this show.
I will pile on, Carl, because we are flirting dangerously with politics here. In that, I agree with you, but I also, my statement always is that you're right, you're an economy of one, but you participate with those around you, thus society. And you are unable to generate, you can't generate revenue if the things next to you aren't healthy. And so thus, so we have to, it is, you can be completely independent, you can look for that, that is super important, but you have to also have the healthy system around you to deliver service into.
All right, I'll buy in on that. Ryan, you got 30 seconds. Any final thoughts?
Absolutely. See, I got way more than 30 seconds of thoughts. The one thing that I will say is it's not about whether technology can improve our economy. It's a question of how are we using it? Are we using it simply to cut the cost of the stuff we already know how to do? Or are we using it to invent new ways of creating value and making people's lives better? That's the upside challenge that I think everybody needs to take away. Stop just thinking about how do I reduce cost. Think about how do you improve life with technology, and I think you're going to find unlimited opportunity.
Thoughts.
Oh, there we go. That's a great way to start the year. All right. I think that's it. We are way out of time. This has been episode 43 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.